And today, July 31, 2003. The order of the agenda today is going to first have the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3654. We'll then return back to the top of the agenda and have the work session on Senate Bill 751. We'll then skip down to public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 912, Senate Bill 918, House Bill 3587, and then finish up with a work session on House Bill 2356. So with that, let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3654 and ask Senator Walker and Representative Rosenbaum and Amy Hanlon come forward.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Vicki Walker. I'm State Senator for District 7 in Eugene, and I'm delighted to be here today to testify on House Bill 3654. This bill came to you from the Senate as Senate Bill 785 on a unanimous vote back in May, and I spent many hours researching this bill and working on it to get it just the right language, and we were successful in that effort and got by off with the insurance lobby in the building. So I think we have a very good product. And what I handed out to you was a copy of the Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act statutory text, and that's where we come from in this bill. And I'll just give you a little background about that, if you don't mind. Congress passed and then President Clinton signed into law the Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act of 1998. It's also known as WICRA. And that's now in front of you. Essentially, the act provides for reconstruction of the affected breast, reconstruction of the other breast to produce a symmetrical appearance, prosthesis, and treatment for physical complications of the mastectomy. And it also required notice to everyone across the country that this was now required under their insurance policy. Oregon adopted the act by reference in 1999, not outright, but just by reference. The act applies to group and individual plans as well as the self-insured. It's important to note that WICRA did not mandate coverage of mastectomy in the first instance, and neither does this bill. This bill just says that if your insurance company provides that coverage, you need to meet these requirements. The Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act was co-chief sponsored by U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, and if you go to her webpage, she actually has information about that on her webpage, and she said that this act will force insurance companies to leave medical decision-making to doctors and their patients. It is long past time for Congress to send a strong message to insurance companies. Medical decisions must be made by medical professionals, not anonymous insurance clerks. And that's where this bill came from. That's why the bill was so important to Congress, and that's why it's important to Oregon. What we have done here with 785 and now 3654 is that we have clarified some of the provisions of that law to make it more flexible and to meet the needs of Oregonians. And Amy Hanlon is here on my right to talk to you in a moment about what that means for her. Specifically, the bill changes the federal law in this way. It changes the language, the federal language, to say that the decision is determined by the attending physician and the enrollee to be part of the enrollee's course or plan of treatment. The background for that change is that experience indicated that some insurance companies in Oregon were not agreeing with a physician's decision for the best course of action for a patient, and Ms. Hanlon will be able to talk to you about that. The second change from the federal law is that we have added language. We've added the language to say that breast reconstruction, all stages of reconstruction of the breast on which the mastectomy has been performed, including but not limited to nipple reconstruction, skin grafts, and stippling of the nipple and areola. It's hard to imagine, but some insurance plans were refusing to reconstruct the nipple and the areola, saying that it was not required as part of the breast reconstruction. I found that unconscionable. So that has been changed, and we have covered all of those areas of the breast. The third change that I think is significantly important, because it saves costs, that we add a new provision that provides for a single pre-authorization for all mastectomy-related services to the treatment plan, as well as expediting review of a dispute between the insured and the insurer according to statute ORS 743.857 that we actually passed last session. I did not know we'd passed that provision until we had the hearings in the Senate, and we learned that we had actually passed that provision in law, and it's an excellent provision, so we've cited it here to make sure they get expedited review. And the single pre-authorization was extremely important because also in the hours of research that we put into this bill, polling doctors and insurance companies, we found that oftentimes the pre-authorization would have to be in parts. And if a woman, for instance, and we must not forget that men also have mastectomies, but often, more often than not, it's women. But when someone would go in for treatment, and perhaps they were ill that day, and if you're ill, you cannot get treatment, you cannot have any further surgical procedures, so they would have to reschedule. Some insurance companies would require you to go through the pre-authorization process all over again, which is absolutely ridiculous. Cost time for staff, cost time and money. So this bill allows for a single pre-authorization. And as I indicated, all the insurance industry signed off on the bill, actually helped with some of the language. And that's, I think, why we passed this bill unanimously in the Senate, and I hope that you can do that today. And with that, we'll let Ms. Hanlon speak.
I'm a breast cancer survivor, and my name, as you know, is Amy Hanlon. I began this process with Representative Diane Rosenbaum about a year or so ago at this point. And I'm here to testify in support of the House Bill 3654. When I was first diagnosed with cancer, I went through treatment, and for a variety of reasons, my doctors advised me to have a double mastectomy. And as you've heard, by federal law, insurance companies that provide mastectomies must also provide for reconstruction. However, when I discussed various options available with my doctor, and we came up with the best option for my particular medical history, my HMO refused that particular option. And I later discovered that the same HMO pays for the option I had wanted in California, because California recently passed a law that requires those decisions to be determined by physicians, not by HMOs. I appealed several times, was denied several times, and so because I felt that it was important for me to proceed with the procedure rather than wait, and I was forced to pay out of pocket while I was going through all of this. The point is, when women are going through the physical and emotional trauma of cancer and mastectomies, they should not have to deal with this additional trauma. Unless the laws are changed, there's absolutely no motivation for insurance companies to change what they deem to be the standard of care. Women should not have to battle their HMOs while battling a life-threatening disease. They should not have to compromise their life or their future surgeries because of reconstruction that they were forced to accept. I did not get involved in this political process to promote the reconstructive approach I selected, because it's not necessarily the best approach for everyone, and that is precisely the point. Women and men of Oregon need a breast cancer and reconstruction bill that requires the decisions for the type of reconstruction to be made between the patient and the doctor, and not to be determined by an HMO company. So I strongly urge you to consider and to support the breast reconstruction bill 3654. Thank you.
That's
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, I am Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative for House District 42, and very pleased to appear today in support of House Bill 3654. I believe a number of the members of this committee are co-sponsors of this bill. I think, Madam Vice Chair, you are one of the co-sponsors, so I probably will be preaching to the choir in what I'm about to say, but my testimony, which appears on Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Act letterhead, is as co-chair, as is Senator Walker, the other co-chair of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, which is a bipartisan group of legislators and advocates promoting issues that will benefit women's health and safety. And so it's very much my pleasure to be able to see this bill moving forward on the House side today. 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer in their lifetime. Here in Oregon, that means that this year, 2,600 Oregon women will be stricken with breast cancer. And I don't think that statistic is so astounding anymore to those of us who've started to talk to our sisters, our mothers, our friends, our wives, because it is just that common. So that is why when my constituent, Amy Hamlin, who I think is a courageous survivor, came to me in the last interim, we started to work on this issue and see if there were some things that could be done in Oregon law that would make it easier for women who are getting post-mastectomy treatment to deal with the sometimes confusing maze of insurance companies. And I think that we have done that here in this bill. I want to applaud Senator Walker particularly, who was the chief sponsor and architect of Senate Bill 785, because when we first started to deal with this area, we found that there was a really confusing tangle of Oregon statutes, so confusing that when we first went to legislative council, they were even unaware that we had references to the federal law in Oregon law. And so what this bill has done is pulled together in one statute, the requirements of the federal law, along with a requirement for there to be only one pre-authorization for all post-mastectomy breast reconstruction treatment. And I think that though the bill may not make huge changes by bringing those things together in a nexus, it is going to make it easier for people like Amy in the future. So I, again, thank Senator Walker for figuring all that out and finding a way to make this bill work and finding a way to get it to pass unanimously, which it did on the Senate side. I also want to mention, though it's not in this bill, that when Amy's situation happened, there was another law that wasn't yet on the books, and that is the Patient Protection Act that we passed last session. So that Patient Protection Act required independent review of insurance companies' decisions, and so that's another thing that's in Oregon statute that I think will help people like Amy if they feel like their treatment is inappropriately denied by an insurance company. Finally, I would like to thank Speaker Karen Minnis, who took this issue on and became the chief sponsor of this bill. I think we have probably by now almost every member of the House of Representatives signed on to the bill. I hope it will have a similar popularity on the Senate side where Senator John Minnis is its chief sponsor. I thank you, Chair Doyle, for holding this hearing today. I think this bill is an example of true bipartisan cooperation in the interests of the health of our Oregon citizens, and hope that you will send this bill speedily to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, this panel? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we
look forward to having that come to the Senate so we can all join in with you.
Marcia Kelly.
Chair Doyle and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition of Oregon. Our members include the Oregon Older Women's League, Delta Kappa Gamma, Salem YWCA, the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the Oregon National Association of Women, and the American Association of University Women of Oregon. In all, over 10,000 members. And I will make my testimony probably briefer than the list of organizations. This bill will be a comfort for women as they're going through decisions regarding breast cancer and breast cancer treatment, to know that if they are going to, in fact, need mastectomy, that they won't have to keep on jumping through hoops. treatment of cancer has improved so much in the last 15 to 20 years that there are more cancer survivors, and I'm just pleased that this bill would help Oregon women in making those medical decisions with their doctors, which we think is the appropriate place for medical decisions regarding mastectomy and post-mastectomy construction.
Any questions? All right, thank you. And seeing no one further to testify on this bill, close the public hearing on House Bill 3654. Open up a work session on House Bill 3654.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3654 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3654 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Right, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Yep, excused.
Aye.
Aye. Chair votes aye, and I think this one probably will have some discussion on the floor. Carrier?
The nurse.
Actually.
No.
Trying to think.
No, maybe.
We got Speaker Minnis kind of heading it up on this end. Why don't we name Speaker Minnis as the carrier? Close the and House Bill 3654 then goes to the floor of the due pass recommendation, and that closes the work session on House Bill 3654. And thank you, Rick. And we can now open up a work session on Senate Bill 751. And committee members, we have the Dash 14s are presented to you for your consideration. And Senator Metzger, would you mind coming forward?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator, for coming forward. The Dash 14s are slightly different from the Dash 12s that you had proposed. In essence, they, I think the differences are that the, or was it Dash 12s that you had?
No. The Dash 9s I presented, Mr. Chair.
Right, Dash 9s. Let's see. There was right. I think there was another issue. Good. Here, got it. Okay. Your Dash 9s had one piece was in response to the technical concerns of DEQ, which Senator Carter also conveyed about remedial actions, and in essence what the Dash 14s have done is actually conform the remedial actions definition to what we already have in statute.
Yes.
And then basically it I think subject to my concerns and at my request we removed the governor's designee as a member of this authority and returning it back to the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was it. So,
yeah, Mr. Chair, just for the record, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I looked over your amendment. I think that's you've done an excellent job in providing a composite of the issues that Senator Carter and myself had brought forth in our other amendments, with the additional finding that Senator Carter had brought up. As you mentioned, the remedial action cost funding, tightening the language, I think you have addressed that better. And then in on lines 12 and 13, deleting the language that Senator Carter had pointed out, you know, could be constructed as a dual exercise. And I think this is a tighter amendment, and I certainly do support that.
All right. And I guess in some of the issues that Senator Carter has brought up, as well as Representative Hansen,
there was several issues that I think that basically we weren't interested, or I wasn't interested in pursuing, and I felt that if we wanted to designate several members, actually having to be in districts relating to the Superfund site kind of removed, I think, the whole concept that you've been promoting, which is that this is a statewide resource, and certainly there is a Superfund site in Portland, but it's Willamette River is what we're dealing with here. And I guess I wasn't interested in pursuing that piece of it. And then I think the other issues for Senator Carter pretty well have been addressed, have they not?
Yeah, I think we've done the best that we possibly can on that.
Okay.
And I do appreciate, by the way, just for the record, her staff's input on those, and I think this is a better bill as a result of that.
All right. Any questions, Senator Metzger?
Yes.
Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Can you clarify again what's in the amendment sent on the representation of... did the amendments address that?
As I believe as the chair's amendment, which follows through the A9, does not change the A.N. Gross bill in terms of membership, so that the Speaker of the House, Representative Modest Anderson, would appoint two members of the House, and the President of the Senate would appoint two members of the Senate. Right. So, and I think what the chairman is saying is that those who have particular interest in that, I'm sure, will be well received by both leaders of both houses.
I still haven't found it. So,
Representative Hansen, I believe, offered the dash tens, which designated two members of from each body to have to be in that representative district.
And that's what I want to clarify.
And that is not part of this.
Okay.
It's still left up to the presiding officers to decide, as opposed to, I guess, making it more political that way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair.
Right. Thank you, Senator. And Representative Flores? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the dash A14 amendments to Senate Bill 751.
Representative Flores has moved adoption of the dash A14 amendments to Senate Bill 751. Any further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, then I would move Senate Bill 751 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 751 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Discussion? Representative Moss Anderson.
Just a comment. I truly hope that the Willamette River cleanup will progress more rapidly with this bill. There are people out there that say that this it still won't make any difference. And I just want to get on the record that maybe this will just provide enough impetus with to truly address and hopefully speed up that cleanup, which is so vitally necessary.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would certainly echo those comments, and I agree with them. I still have some concerns about the construction of this of the membership in this bill. I share the kinds of concerns that Representative Hansen raised about the nature of the thing. This certainly is a statewide issue. There's no question about that. All of us, all across the state, have a keen interest in the cleanup of the Willamette River Harbor area, both for aesthetic. I guess I should say for among aesthetic, environmental, and of course certainly economic reasons, but nothing like being on the on site to have and be reminded of it on a daily basis to have an interest in it. And so I was very interested in Representative Hansen's proposal. I think having said that, I'm not going to oppose the bill, but I do have that reservation.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion? All right, thank you. I too share, I think, the concerns of the committee that, and concerns of Senator Metzger that brought this bill forward originally, that it's very difficult when the state has to basically stand behind the federal government, the DEQ, and or EPA, and finding out when our own harbor is going to become a priority for funding. And if there are other alternatives out there, I think it makes sense that we pursue those alternatives. I think this authority is a good idea to try to accomplish that. And so, too, is why I guess I was interested in removing the governor's designee as one of the members. I mean, if this is really going to have the punch needed to get the river cleaned up in a more expeditious manner than what we currently are experiencing, the governor has to be there, the legislators have to be there, and I'm hoping this is what's going to help us through this process so that ultimately we can get the Willamette River back to a more healthy state than what it is. Can you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 And chair votes aye. Carrier for this one? Okay. Sure, what?
Okay.
You'll carry it? All right. Thank you, Representative. Representative Monis Anderson will be the carrier. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 751. Now open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 912. Mark Nelson. And Doug Myers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Glass Packaging Institute. This bill was originally House Bill 3144, came out of your Environment Committee, passed the House with, I believe, 4 no votes. As it came out of the House, it would have eliminated the requirement in statute that for recycling content of 50%. That particular bill got caught up in the closures over there in the Senate, and it was reinstituted in the Senate Bill 912 and was amended in the Senate, and you now have that before you. Give you a very brief background. Since 1993, we have had a recycled content requirement in the statute, and we are now at 35%. Oregon has one glass manufacturer, Owens, who has Owens, Illinois, who has up in North Portland, and who has been really the darling nationally of in terms of recycled content. Part of that is because of Oregon's bottle bill. They have a recycled content which is over 50% now. Part of the problem is that Oregon and California are the two states that had a 50% recycled content. California repealed theirs. They never went to 50% because they did not have the cullet, the actual glass available in order to get to that level. In Oregon, we've had changes, especially over the last couple of years. City of Portland, for example, has gone to a, rather than the three glass colors in terms of its pickup, its recycling, it has gone to a mixed color, which again makes it even more difficult. In any event, we wanted to remove the 50% requirement, which was looming coming at us in January of 2004. We have worked with Doug and DEQ and have agreed to the amendment that you see from the Senate, which is simply to postpone that 50% requirement until 2008 on the chance that there might be some technology that makes the separation of the cullet easier from a mixed cullet batch. So I think that Doug and DEQ wanted the opportunity to see if anything changes in the marketplace. We're in agreement with that and have agreed to that Senate amendment, which is now before you today. So,
Mr. Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Doug Myers, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Recyclers. The recyclers are the ones that actually do the recycling in the state. About 400 members, every county, big members like Weyerhaeuser, Owens, Illinois. individual members, and we are in support of extending the deadline by 4 more years, and I hope you listen very carefully to everything Mark said, because I'm not going to repeat it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Any questions, panel? All right. Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
No one else to testify on Senate Bill 912, so we'll close the public hearing, and we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 912. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 912 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 912 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Colleagues, here's a recycling bill. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a good one. The lack of other witnesses leads me to believe that the recitals are agreed to. The very recitals we've been hearing are agreed to by other potential interested parties in this bill, and therefore I'll support it.
All right. And as Mr. Nelson noted, this was just kind of a remake of House Bill 3144, which passed the floor at a 48-4 vote. So, with I guess 8 different excused absences. So, and maybe that's part of the reason why you're not getting much opposition or hearing any different views. Further discussion?
It may also be, of course, that the technical problems that they're having are exactly correct, and everybody agrees to that.
That's absolutely true. Thank you. Let's call the roll.
Aye.
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 And Chair votes aye, and this being a recycled bill from before, we'll put it on the consent calendar without objection. Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you, Ray. Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 912 work session then is closed, and we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 918 and ask Rick Partapillo and Bill Linden come forward.
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden representing Linn County. I'll very briefly describe to you how this bill got here. It started out as House Bill 3274, which came out of the General Government Committee early in session on a unanimous vote and passed the House with 1 no vote. Went over to the Senate, was assigned to the Senate Business Committee, got caught up in a variety of issues relating to the bills in that committee. And so the Senate Rules Committee was generous enough to refile the bill for us, came out of that committee, passed the Senate, and is now in front of you today. I'm going to ask Rick Partapillo, who is the Environmental Health Program Manager for Linn County, to describe to you the substance of SB 918.
Good afternoon, Representative Will, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm here testifying on behalf of the Linn County Board of Commissioners in favor of Senate Bill 918.
And if we can get your name.
My name is Rick Partapillo, Environmental Health Program Manager for Linn County. The Linn County Board of Commissioners requested this legislation out of concern for food safety in the hope of correcting an apparent oversight in the existing statute relating to inspection of mobile food units. Mobile food units currently are the only food service establishments that may operate in Oregon without an assurance of regular inspections. This occurs when operators of these units obtain a license from one county and by virtue of their mobile nature operate in many other counties throughout the state, most of that in the valley, without notice required to the county with they're operating within. Senate Bill 918 would remedy this oversight by requiring that the operators of these units would simply provide a notice to the local health department of the county they're operating in. The health department would then
have the option of making an inspection or not. And I would be glad to answer any questions the committee might have.
Questions? Representative Close?
Just one correction, Mr. Chair. This did not come out of general government. This bill on the House side came out of the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, and there was, I just want the committee to know there was wide support for it.
Right. And I guess I'd like to clarify just on the staff measure summary as well. It says that Senate Bill 918 is similar to House Bill 3274.
It's identical.
It's actually identical.
So,
any other questions? But Representative Barnhart.
Two comments. One is we don't want to admit that to Ramona because she'll say it's out of order. And the second one is really on the bill itself, a substantial thing. I'm very appreciative of having this bill here. I go to fairs and community events and farmers markets and things like that. I eat food that's been produced in, immediately on the scene in one of these mobile units, and I'm very appreciative of the fact that local health agency is going to know about it being there and will have the chance to make sure that it's set up correctly.
Another question.
Representative Sanderson.
Is it a problem for those mobile units that maybe travel the state, or isn't that very common?
I think it's not very common. We don't have data really on how many travel, but anecdotally, I would estimate about 10% are nomadic. Most of these operate within their county of origin primarily. There are a number of these that are quite nomadic and operate throughout the state, and this bill would require them to provide the notice to all of them, but primarily affecting those, to provide the notice to the local health department.
Okay. Further questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Seeing no one further to testify on this, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 918. We'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 918. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 918 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 918 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Great. Call the roll, please.
Representative
Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative
Close. Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, and once again, as a recycled bill, we'll go ahead and put it on the consent calendar without objection. So ordered. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 918. Thank you, Rick. And we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3587. And Ted Hughes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, sir. Testimony to your abilities here that you get a gun bill actually before the Rules Committee.
Yes.
I don't know how that happened.
I wanted to talk to the committee about that phraseology. I may get the bill in a little jam when it gets to the floor, I would think. Mr. Chairman, Ted Hughes, representing the Motion Picture Association of America. I believe the committee administrator has furnished you a one-page copy from the Motion Picture Association, a summary of the need for the bill and what the bill does. That's not the case. I have some other copies here. I believe she told me that you have this. Great. So, I won't read it. I know that you've read it thoroughly. And what it's all about, of course, is with all the new technological developments in the high-tech industry, it's created great possibilities, jobs, and economic growth for the motion picture producers and the motion picture industry. It's also benefited those who steal the products. And the Motion Picture Association of America would ask that you introduce this bill and pass this bill, creating penalties for people that intentionally steal the product of the industry. Basically, it's that simple. It is a problem with the industry, the magnitude, as you see in that release of $3 billion annually. It's not just a insignificant amount for the industry, and state by state, they're moving into the state legislature is asking that this kind of legislation be introduced. That, Mr. Chairman, is about the one-page summary.
All right. Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you describe a bit further why this needs to be considered a Class C felony? And trespass, if I recall correctly, is a misdemeanor under most circumstances.
I believe you're right, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart. I believe trespass is. This is goes beyond trespass. This is theft of personal property.
And okay.
I believe most of that is in the felony area. One of the concerns that were, I'm glad you asked that, one of the concerns about this bill was by the Department of Justice, Mr. Phil Lemon. I didn't know, but his job is to analyze the criminal statutes and all the bills dealing with felonies and find out how it's going to jam up the court system. I'm glad we have someone looking at that. And he was concerned that initially about how much prosecution would take place in this, and I put him in touch with the general counsel for the Motion Picture Association. Mm-hmm. They were on several conference calls. I think I can say no more than one or two cases a year would ever be brought in Oregon. The idea that the bill is there, it sends the message that the industry wants to send.
Any further questions?
Well, I just note, excuse me, I just note that the staff summary indicates that it may have a fiscal impact, and we don't have a statement. And maybe I'm being overly cautious, but I wonder if that's a concern. I mean, I certainly think the point of the bill makes perfectly good sense to me. Is there a new one? I'm sorry.
Last sentence on the page.
Okay. Great. That's the only reservation that I have about this bill is where it fits in the classification system. And part of the reason why I have that concern is that it does raise the trespass from a misdemeanor to a felony, and I simply don't understand. I simply don't remember the criminal classification system well enough to be confident in my own knowledge of whether that's the right place to put it or not. And so that would be a concern for me, and as I look at this bill or this amendment.
Okay, we have someone else who may be testifying to that.
Fine.
In a moment. Further questions, Mr. Hughes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Well, wait a minute, Ted. I'm not done. Let's,
I just try and slip out every chance I get.
I don't blame you. But looking at the even the definition of an audiovisual recording device, as an example right now, there's new cell phone technology that's coming out that basically is... provides for the ability to take photographs, and I'm trying to see how does a theater, for instance, you know, when is it when they're saying, you know, we're going to be citing you or we're going to try and get you arrested for bringing in a cell phone versus, you know, something that I think is probably more in line with what you're trying to achieve, which is people that are just sitting in a movie theater recording a movie so that they can send it off to the black market. How are we drawing that line?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that. The same question the Department of Justice asked the General Counsel of the Motion Picture Association, roughly the same question. I believe this is one of those bills that sends messages, and like many pieces of legislation are never enforced or very seldom enforced, but they're there as a weapon to use in case it happens. And I really cannot answer that question.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? All right. Thank you very much. Andrew Meyer.
Good Chair Doyle, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. We are really concerned about this bill, and I think some of the issues have been brought up already, but I will touch on them in another. A C felony is 5 years. I will direct the committee to a few other statutes. Trespassing is normally a C or a B misdemeanor. Criminal trespassing, the second degree, 164245, is a C misdemeanor, and what we're talking about there is 6 months maximum. So there's a huge difference between what normally is trespass in second degree entering a premises. In addition,
Andrew, while you're sure. Just looking at that issue, how do you reconcile that with the deterrent issue, or what we're trying to deter here is the theft.
Chair Doyle, good question. I would direct you to 164.875, which is already unlawful to do videotape recording. A person commits the crime of unlawful videotape recording if they produce or sale any videotape or without consent of the owner of the motion picture imprinted therein. So you've already got the fact that if someone goes in, tapes it, and attempts to sell it or offer it for sale, they are committing a crime, and that is actually only a B misdemeanor. So you've got that in. I mean, I think what they're going for is you come in.
I'm on the same topic, if I could.
Sure. Let's.
Yeah. Is it already a crime to tape a movie in the manner that this contemplates, or not?
My flaw here is I do not practice criminal law, and I wish very much the folks who are more versed in that area were here today. They're not. I think by that. Attempting to, I haven't had a chance to survey the whole of the statutes to be able to fully inform you in the scope of the coverage of videotape. We know it's unlawful to be trespassing, and if they're engaging in unlawful activity, which would be taping without permission, then they can be trespassed out, especially if they remain there. We know that if they attempt to sell it, produce it, that that's another separate charge of criminal activity.
Well, the reason I raise the point is that if it's already a crime to tape or to attempt to tape a movie in a situation like that, then you've committed a burglary by going there for the purpose of taping the movie. And that's a Class C felony and not in a dwelling, isn't it?
Burglary in the first degree is... There is second degree burglary, and I'm just looking at it because, again, that is a C felony.
The intention of going into a building for the purpose of committing a crime is already a burglary. So I'm wondering, I mean, if it's a crime to tape in that situation, then you've already committed a burglary by going there to do that, haven't you?
Well, Representative Doyle, Representative Barnhart, the one thing I can't tell this committee for certain is that going in and taping is already a crime. I can't, obviously going in and taping and then attempting to sell that versus private use, if you attempt to sell it, that's clearly a crime. Trespassing, going in there and engaging in unlawful activity, I mean, they're trespassing if the owner of the premises does not want them engaging in that activity.
Correct.
Remember, any private place can trespass you out for engaging activity that they don't want, as long as it's within the constraints of the law. So they already have that vehicle. I don't know if it is a crime simply to go in and tape because, I apologize, I just got this and I haven't been able to survey that, so I say I can't tell you it may be. The one thing I want to point out in the additional flaw in the version that you have before you is in Section 1, it doesn't actually have you taping. It simply is that you commit the crime while you're in possession of a device if the person knowingly carries that device into the facility. It doesn't require that they turn it on, that they record, or have any intent to subsequently obtain that motion picture. And so that's an additional flaw to it, that if you're going to proceed with this at all, I would urge you to require that there be an intentional intent to tape, an actual taping. Mr. Hughes stated that this is intentionally stealing the product from the industry, but as written, this doesn't have actually any stealing going on.
All right, further questions?
I'd certainly be happy to get the committee more information, having had a chance to consult with those professionals down here who handle the criminal area of law far more often than I do. So if you're going to revisit this, I'd love to get their input on it.
Well, and I share some of those concerns as well, and I would, I guess I'm
one of the concerns I have is that we have a public hearing now on a bill that actually does relate to firearms, and I'm concerned, you know, that I guess others might think we might do something else with it, and I want to assure everyone we are not doing anything else with it but this particular bill. Representative Close?
Mr. Chair, I thought it said relating to criminal trespass.
Well, it does. It's criminal trespass while in possession of firearm.
But the relating clause does not include firearms, correct?
Correct. No, that's right. I'm sorry. The relating clause is just criminal trespass, but I just want to make sure people were not getting any heartburn over keeping a bill alive, basically, that has that kind of issue attached to it. So I think if we can, we can get a little bit more, some of these other questions answered before we move forward on this bill.
Yeah. Before we deprive somebody of their freedom for 5 years, we ought to make sure we're doing it right. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And that closes the public hearing on House Bill 3587. And we can now go to work session on House Bill 2356. All right. And, colleagues, we have the Dash 3 amendment, Dash A3. Amendment for you, for your consideration, and this particular amendment has had a legislative fiscal office analysis and finds that there is no expenditure impact on this particular amendment. And yet, because this is a different issue than what we've had before, I at least wanted to get some additional discussion on the record as well. And so to do that, I wanted to see.
This came out of our committee, so we've got it.
I have the wrong. I have 2556.
Let's ask John DiLorenzo to come forward. And then we're also going to be asking Tom O'Connor to come in after Mr. DiLorenzo. And if there's anybody from the City of Portland that has interest, we'll follow up with those folks as well. Mr. DiLorenzo.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney with the firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Portland General Electric, in support of the Dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2356. The Dash A3 amendments prohibit the City of Portland from acquiring, through the exercise of the condemnation power, property belonging to an electric company when the acquisition is for the purpose of providing electricity services. The amendments do not prohibit the exercise of condemnation powers for any other reason, nor do they prohibit the acquisition of PGE by the City of Portland through other means, like participation in the Enron bankruptcy bid process or a subsequent purchase of the assets. Although PGE has no position with respect to other mechanisms which might be available to the city for acquisition of the company, it is absolutely opposed to acquisition through condemnation for a number of reasons. These reasons are not only particular to PGE, but should also be of great concern to you, who either have constituents who are served by PGE or are from counties or other local governments which derive property taxes, franchise fees, or other financial benefits from PGE or other utilities that are privately owned. First, were the City of Portland to successfully condemn the assets of PGE, ratepayers located outside of the city limits would have absolutely no protections with regard to rates. Should the City of Portland exercise its condemnation powers and acquire the assets, there would no longer be any Public Utility Commission oversight relating to the rate base attributable to the assets that were acquired through condemnation. Ratepayers served by these assets would be completely subject to the whim and politics of the City of Portland, as there would be no legal governance document in place. And since these persons located outside of the city limits would have no right to vote or otherwise have their voices heard. Although PUC oversight regarding safety would remain, the Public Utility Commission would not have an opportunity to approve any change in control, nor would there be any Public Utility Commission oversight available to protect ratepayers. The City of Portland could include in rates a variety of social engineering uses, which, although saleable in the City of Portland, might be found to be repugnant by ratepayers in your districts and those located throughout the state. The City of Portland might also decide to invest in costly infrastructure projects, like undergrounding of utility facilities within the city limits, thereby spreading the costs to ratepayers in cities and counties located outside of the city's boundaries. The exercise of condemnation powers by the City of Portland could also deprive counties and local schools from tax revenues that they so desperately need. PGE has facilities located around the state, many of which would be subject to the City of Portland's condemnation authority. PGE is one of Oregon's largest payers of property taxes and franchise fees to local jurisdictions. PGE's service territory includes 51 cities in Multnomah, Polk, Marion, Clackamas, Yamhill, and Washington counties. PGE paid more than $41 million in franchise and privilege taxes in 2003. Altogether, PGE paid $25,900,000 in property taxes last year for power plants and other facilities in Columbia, Crook, Deschutes, Jefferson, Gilliam, Hood River, Klamath, Lake, Marion, Morrow, Multnomah, Polk, Washington, and Yamhill counties. If PGE's assets are condemned by the City of Portland, there would be no legal requirement for the City of Portland to continue to pay these taxes. How could you be assured that the city would continue to pay these property taxes? Charities, which benefit from PGE's largesse, would no longer be able to rely upon this level of contributions. PGE is one of Oregon's largest corporate citizens. In 2002, PGE invested more than $1 million in community contributions and sponsorships in Oregon, and its employees gave more than 100,000 volunteer hours. Government entities do not provide a significant level of contribution or sponsorships to these types of investments that go back to the community. Should the City of Portland exercise its condemnation powers, how will these organizations replace the contributions that were once provided by PGE? Would financial contributions designated by the Portland City Council fund programs or organizations outside of Portland? Or would customers outside of Portland city boundaries be left out? Condemnation does not mean cheaper rates. Condemnation is a dangerous course for a city like Portland to pursue, and it requires the ability to immediately generate cash if it is to take immediate possession of property. However, condemnation is not only a risky strategy for the city, it's a risky strategy for Oregon ratepayers as a whole. The initiation of condemnation proceedings against PGE's assets would cost millions of dollars that ultimately would be paid for by ratepayers. If the city commissioners who have been quoted in the newspapers mean what they say, the threat is real. A condemnation action would take years to come to fruition. The uncertainty associated with a condemnation action would certainly create inefficiencies within the company, as well as inefficiencies within the City of Portland. The city could well be liable for huge professional costs and other damages in a variety of scenarios. First, if a court were to award PGE more than the city's final offer, the city would be liable for millions of dollars in attorney's fees, professional fees, and costs under the current condemnation statutes. Second, if the city were unable to generate enough cash to fulfill an ultimate award beyond its final offer, or should the city otherwise abandon the proceeding, it could also be liable for millions of dollars of attorney's fees, professional fees, and costs. Where is the city's evidence that condemnation of a utility as large and as complex as PGE would provide rate decreases for customers? Where are the projected condemnation costs and consumer rate projections? Is it good for Oregon's economy or reputation to condemn businesses when Oregon has the highest unemployment rate in the nation? And will a condemnation fight between PGE and the City of Portland scare off businesses locating in Oregon? The City of Portland, as the owner of condemned PGE assets, would have difficulty gaining access to BPA preference power and could dilute current preference power available to other public customers. And this is an issue that should be of particular concern to those of you who have constituents who are not necessarily served by PGE, but maybe are served by public utility districts. Low-cost federal power is a thing of the past. BPA has raised rates by 46%, with another increase under discussion. BPA's preference power is fully subscribed, which means that adding PGE's large customer base to the BPA preference pool would require BPA to purchase more power on the wholesale market. PGE's thermal plants, the coal and natural gas plants, cannot be condemned, and there are serious legal questions about the takeover of hydro plants. Would electric rates go up for BPA's existing preference customers in Oregon as BPA attempts to accommodate the city of Portland's new gigantic status as a preference customer? Probably. For these reasons and many more, the exercise of condemnation powers by the city of Portland against the assets of PGE is a very bad idea. The fact that certain members of the city council have publicly stated in the newspapers that they intend to keep condemnation alive as a viable option indicates that legislative action is necessary. It is necessary to ensure the viability of the ongoing bid process, to protect your constituents from the loss of any meaningful review of rates, to protect your constituents from having to contribute to programs over which they will have no influence or control, to protect nonprofits, protect schools, cities, counties, and the state from potential losses of significant resources and taxes, all in favor of the city of Portland. Now, much can be said about the city's mishandling of agencies currently under its control. The closest corollary to a city-run electric utility is the much smaller City Water Bureau operation. That operation was a fraction of the size of PGE, and yet resulted in tens of millions of dollars of losses by virtue of the city's mismanagement of its own billing system. The exercise of condemnation powers by the city of Portland against the assets of PGE would make the new municipal utility the third largest in the nation. If the city makes mistakes of the same magnitude as those that have been made managing the City Water Bureau, who will pick up the extra expense? The likely answer is the ratepayers, your constituents. If the city finances condemnation of PGE's assets through revenue bonds and there are unanticipated costs down the road, who will pay for them? The answer is the same, the ratepayers, your constituents. We urge your adoption of the amendments to protect your constituents, our customers, employees, and shareholders. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's not think about condemnation, but let's just take the situation of Enron and all of the liabilities that they have with the bankruptcy that they've gone through. What would prevent them from distributing their liability, the debt, to the ratepayers, or take advantage of PGE and then therefore spread the cost to the ratepayers? Isn't that the same type of thing? I mean, we're...
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, no, that is not the same kind of thing at all. First of all, the ratepayers are only responsible to pay in rates those portions of expenses that are deemed attributable to rates by the Public Utility Commission. The Public Utility Commission will not allow many expenditures of PGE to be included in rates today. There is no way that Enron can, quote, distribute its debts to anyone other than to itself. Enron's debts are only would only be borne by PGE if PGE were legally responsible for Enron's debts. Enron and PGE are separate corporations. PGE is a wholly owned subsidiary. What we have here is a bankrupt shareholder who happens to own 100% of the stock of a very well-financed company. Just because the shareholder has massive debts does not mean that the shareholder can pass those debts on to a company that it happens to own. The bankruptcy proceeding is structured such that secured creditors will be paid first from assets that are secured. After that, to the extent that secured creditors have no more funds available, they become unsecured creditors. There is a priority schedule with respect to how unsecured creditors are paid in a Chapter 11. There is not enough money available in the Enron bankruptcy as a whole to pay all of the unsecured creditors 100 cents on the dollar. And so under the Chapter 11 proceeding, there is a plan that Enron is producing that must be approved by every class of creditor and then must be approved by the court. One scenario would envision Enron finding a buyer for the PGE stock because the stock is an asset of Enron, not the company itself. If that does not work, then another scenario would involve distributing PGE stock to each of the unsecured creditors of Enron proportionately.
as some compensation for its creditor claims. That is not tantamount to distributing stock to Enron. The creditors are not Enron. The creditors are upset with Enron. The creditors are owed money by Enron. And so under that scenario, PGE stock might possibly be owned by tens of thousands of persons and would probably be tradable on the exchange. But the short answer is no, Enron's liabilities would not be distributed to PGE, and even if PGE had its own liabilities, they would not be attributable to ratepayers because the Public Utility Commission would not allow it.
Does PGE have any liabilities?
PGE has contingent liabilities. They have all been reserved for, and our filings with the Securities Exchange Commission make it clear how we have reserved for each and every one of the lawsuits in which we are named as a party. There's been a significant amount of misinformation that abounds regarding PGE's status as a defendant in various class action cases. One thing that should be noted is that almost every other electricity provider in the country has been listed as defendants in those suits. And in addition to that, PGE and its investors and its bankers have properly reserved, in our view, for those contingent liabilities. PGE has this last year completed a very successful financing of some of its operations. Wall Street does not appear to be at all concerned about the extent of these contingent liabilities and believes that PGE is properly reserved for them.
Just PGE is sort of whole, sort of an asset, a good asset, and I would assume, well, I don't know enough about all of the particulars, but it is in their best interest for PGE to still remain a subsidiary of Enron?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ross Anderson, first of all, PGE is a very well-financed, well-operated company. It is, in fact, a jewel. It is the jewel of all of the assets of Enron. Enron is a shareholder. Enron is broke. Enron must account to its creditors. It is up to the creditors to decide whether it is worth seeking a buyer for all of the shares en bloc, in which case, of course, the Public Utility Commission would be able to approve, because that would be a change of control that the PUC could approve. Or it might be in the interest of the creditors to roll the dice, since they are not getting anywhere close to 100 cents on the dollar, to accept the stock, like any other shareholders would accept the stock, in which case there would be tens of thousands of shareholders. The shares would be traded overnight on the New York Stock Exchange, and Portland would have a very large Fortune 500-sized headquarters company in the city of Portland.
Is Enron going to sell PGE no matter what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, I cannot answer that question. I don't represent Enron. I am nowhere close to Enron. Enron's workout expert, Mr. Cooper, has kept alive a number of scenarios. One scenario would be finding a buyer for the stock. Another scenario would be proposing a Chapter 11 plan that would propose, subject to court approval, to distribute the shares to the existing general creditors.
Wouldn't this... Wouldn't this bill take Portland out as a prospective buyer?
Chair Representative Monis Anderson, no, that's hardly the case. In fact, I believe this bill would enhance the bidding process. There are many people who feel that the waving of the saber of condemnation does nothing more than dampen the extent of bids which might be derived from the private sector, because who in their right mind would want to pay a premium for PGE when a city was threatening condemnation of the assets? I believe that what this bill would do would be to focus the city on other options. Those options could still remain participating in the bid process, and as I said earlier in my testimony, the company has no position regarding that, and this bill is not designed to affect that possibility at all.
Just one final... So, you're saying you don't really have any information regarding whether
PGE will be sold or not, so why have the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moss Anderson, the reason is that having the bill is that members of the City Council have made it very clear that they intend to keep condemnation of the assets as a viable option. If that were to occur, it would happen outside of the scope of a legislative session. And if it occurred, because the city has the authority to condemn assets wherever located, it is very, very possible that constituents of many of yours who are served by PGE would no longer have the benefit of any PUC oversight whatsoever as to rates. It would be solely dependent upon what the City of Portland in their discretion decided to do. They would have absolutely no say on how their rates were dedicated to public uses. They would have, your cities and counties would have no right to any longer depend upon property taxes. PGE pays so much in property taxes in Columbia County that many of the schools depend upon the property taxes derived from the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant. These counties and cities would be absolutely helpless. They would be totally subject to the whim of the City of Portland. If I were a legislator from a district that did not include the City of Portland, I would be very concerned about exposing my constituents to that type of threat.
I guess my questions would be to Portland.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have a series of questions that I think are, in some ways, are follow-ups on what Representative Moss Anderson asked. There's a number of points you've made in your presentation which I think are important, and I want to follow up on them if I can here. On several of them, you have a dependent clause which is sort of to the effect that if the City of Portland successfully condemns the assets, then something will result. Is that different from if the City of Portland were to acquire the assets of the company through the bankruptcy system?
Mr. Chair...
Without condemnation, simply through a purchase.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it depends. It is my understanding, but please don't quote me on this, it is my understanding that the City of Portland is unable to own shares of corporations. And so, if that is the case, and if the City of Portland is unable to own the stock of a corporation, to acquire PGE would require it to engage in some kind of a transaction that would result in it ultimately possessing the assets. Were the city to just own stock, and were PGE to remain an Oregon corporation, then PUC approval would still be required for potentially for changes of control and certainly for approval of rates. On the other hand, were the assets to be owned by the City of Portland, the PUC would have no jurisdiction over rate making because of the municipal nature of the ownership. So some of my points would be applicable, but some of them would not be applicable, and it just would all depend on the nature of the transaction.
And following up on that particular point, the same issue also applies to things like property taxes, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it is my understanding that if a municipality happens to own assets located in another municipality, those assets are exempt from property taxation.
But the correct, and that's what you said. But the point I'm making is, doesn't the same issue you were talking about PUC approval? Doesn't that also apply to whether the assets are being held in a corporation that the city owns the stock in rather than owning the asset directly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I know that...
I'm not trying to be argumentative.
No.
I'm just trying to understand the outline of this thing.
Yeah. It would all depend on the nature of the transaction. Were the City of Portland allowed to own stock in corporations, and if it had a minority interest in shares of another corporation, I believe that corporation's assets in another county would be subject to property taxation. Were it the sole shareholder, I don't know what the answer would be. I know if the municipality actually owned the asset would not be subject to property taxation.
Right. And that's true regardless of whether it acquired the asset through condemnation or through an arm's length purchase or in any other way.
Madam Vice Chair and Representative Barnhart, yes, if if a municipality acquired an asset of the utility anyway and owned the asset in its own name outright, that asset would likely be exempt from property taxation.
Okay. Additional follow-up. On page 4 of your presentation, you talk about that thermal plants, coal and natural gas, cannot be condemned. And a serious question, legal question about takeoff hydro. Could you say a little more about that?
Yes. Madam Vice Chair, Representative Barnhart, first of all, there is a statute that expressly prohibits the condemnation of thermal assets.
Okay.
So that is easily answered. With respect to hydro assets...
Do you have a site?
No, but I can supply it to you in very short order. With respect to hydro assets, a hydropower plant services a variety of constituencies. In order to initiate a condemnation, a municipality must first issue a resolution of public need. That begins the condemnation process. There is a case called Emerald People's Utility District versus PacifiCorp. And in the Emerald PUD case, the question arose as to whether a resolution of need that was issued under ORS 35.235 was necessarily conclusive of public need. And although there is a presumption that the issuance of the resolution suggests a public need, that is not the end of the argument. And according to the Emerald People's Utility District case, the court must weigh the greater public good against the least private injury that results in condemnation. In the case of hydro assets that serve a variety of constituencies, one might very well make the argument that the, quote, public good for the city of Portland does not outweigh the public harm for all other constituencies affected by the loss of the hydro asset. And so that matter is totally unresolved, but the Emerald People's Utility District case would certainly come into play.
Okay. And then I think this is my last question, unless it prompts some more. Explain, if you would, why it is that the city of Portland, in its review of its own processes, in making a determination as to whether it wanted to condemn the PGE assets or not, couldn't go through the same analysis that you proposed that we go through in determining that it's not a good idea. I mean, why can't they figure this out rather than having us do it?
Madam Vice Chair and Representative Barnhart, in fact, I think they are reviewing those types of issues presently. They have so far spent in excess of $500,000 on lawyers trying to come up with those answers. I believe their lawyers will probably advise them that condemnation is problematic. But the issue here isn't whether the city feels that it ultimately would utilize condemnation or not. The issue is whether or not the city's statements and their indication that condemnation remains as a tool is enough to pose a threat to your constituencies who are not members of the city of Portland and who would be left defenseless were the city of Portland hell-bent on pursuing this course. That's the issue here. Should a city of this size be permitted to utilize this device at all? That's the issue.
Well, I'd like to comment then on that, and then I'll be finished with this. I think what you pointed out here are a number of problems with our PUC rules and with our property tax law.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you pointed out any problems, at least in that context, with the condemnation law. It is a fact, and you're right, that business assets held by a city aren't subject to property taxes. That would make a lot of sense to me, frankly, but that does not make sense to me. Assets held by a nonprofit that are business assets are subject to tax, and I can't think of a good reason why a city municipal assets that are actually a business shouldn't be subject to tax. Recognizing I live in a place where I get the benefit of that because the Unified Electric Board does not pay real property taxes. And so I think you pointed out some problems with the property tax law and probably with the PUC regulation system
but I don't see that that applies to condemnation. It's a different issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, if I may, I certainly understand your point of view, and I would suggest that you consider whether it would be appropriate then to pose the question to the City of Portland. As one question could be, if you condemned PGE assets located outside of the City of Portland, what would give our city's comfort and our county's comfort to know that the City of Portland would in fact be paying the property tax? But that would be a very valid question to ask.
And I'm here listening, and I expect they'll answer it.
Yes, of course.
Thank you. Mr. DiLorenzo, could you give your opinion for us as to whether the City of Portland, in pursuing condemnation, would in any way impact the bidding process that's currently or may be underway?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I cannot tell you definitively whether the City of Portland's use of the specter of condemnation would necessarily impact the bidding process or not. I suspect it would. And the reason I suspect it would is because there are going to be at least one of two results emerging from the bidding process. Either the bankruptcy court will approve, subject to approval of the PUC, an owner, a buyer of the stock of PGE. The cash that the buyer pays would then go into the bankrupt estate and would be used to pay off creditors, and the buyer would then own PGE. That's one scenario. Another possible scenario is there is no buyer who is willing to come up with a sufficient purchase price that creates a circumstance that leaves the creditors better off than merely being shareholders themselves of PGE. And so one scenario is that the shareholders themselves may be PGE, or maybe may own PGE, the creditors themselves. The reason why I think presenting the specter of condemnation interferes with this process is because it doesn't. You know, if a person or an organization is considering paying a premium for PGE's assets, they're going to be discouraged when the City of Portland is at the same time suggesting that the moment they come into title to the assets, the City of Portland is prepared to condemn the assets. If anything, that type of talk is going to have a limiting and dampening effect on the extent of the bids. It could have such a dampening effect that it makes distribution of the stock to existing creditors a fait accompli. And that is why it is very possible and very dangerous to be waving this threat of condemnation about, because to any sophisticated buyer, they're going to certainly consider that as part of their calculus in determining what price to pay.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Berger.
Yes. Following up on that, the City of Portland has to prove that they have some reason for eminent domain. They just can't go condemn property just because our assets, because they think it's a great idea. Would you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, actually the threshold is quite low. The courts have made it clear that a resolution of need under ORS 35.235 creates a rebuttable presumption that there is a public need for the assets. In the case of hydro assets, I think that would be hotly contested. But if the city decides to condemn a road, its threshold is not all that significant to show that there is, in fact, a public need. Normally, the issuance of the resolution is enough. Where the cases become convoluted is in the determination of what the purchase price will ultimately be. So I believe that, I mean, certainly whether or not there is a public interest, the city's public interest is high enough to condemn all the assets or not, would be hotly contested. But it is very possible that the city could meet the threshold, at least with respect to some assets.
One of the things that concerns me, coming from a rural area of Oregon, is this would be a very, very large asset for the City of Portland. And wouldn't they be first in line as far as power is concerned in being able to get power from Bonneville?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, during my testimony, I commented
about that. Excuse me, but I apologize to you. Someone had driven 3 hours to see me, and I was in rules, so I had to
I certainly understand that. I'm just trying to direct you to where in my testimony I talked about that. It was number 5 on page 4, and my point was that BPA's preference power is already fully subscribed. And by adding PGE's customer base to the mix, the dilution factor would be extraordinary. And all of a sudden, BPA would have to figure out how it would either redivide the pie or how it would increase prices to satisfy the new dynamic of supply and demand that would be created. So, yes, I would think that any current user of BPA power should be really concerned about the specter of Portland joining in that BPA power scenario.
One other argument that I've heard is that this might set a precedent. I don't see in the Dash 3 amendments how that sets much of a precedent. It's the population level is stipulated, and it limits it to an electric company providing electric services. So I wonder if you might comment on that.
Chair, Representative Verger, I agree with you completely. This sets no precedent whatsoever. This is this bill is designed to address a special circumstance.
Further discussion? No questions? All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your hospitality.
And also ask Tom O'Connor and Jeff Bissonnette to come forward, representing Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. I'm sorry, Tom's not representing Cub. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom O'Connor. I'm representing the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, which is an organization representing the existing municipally owned electric systems in Oregon. I guess I just want to try to draw this back to a couple fundamentals. Electricity is an essential public service. It's different than so many other things. It's something that we absolutely cannot do without. We usually don't pay too much, a lot of attention to it. You know, we flip the switch and it's on. And for these large monopolies that have been granted that monopoly authority, we generally rely on the PUC to set rates and determine day-to-day policies in the public interest. And that generally works okay. But occasionally, you come across a situation where the behavior of that monopoly is so egregious to the people in the local community that and the protections that are there from the PUC or from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission are insufficient, that the second important protection that the public has potentially comes into place, and that is the public's fundamental right in this state and across the nation that if they are dissatisfied, if they are so dissatisfied with the service that they are getting from this monopoly, they have the fundamental right to take over that service and provide it as a public service. After going through a legal proceeding, an established legal proceeding requires a jury determination on what's just compensation and so on. But the point is, again, that that the public has that fundamental right. And it's not exercised very often. You don't see a lot of municipalization, so-called, you know, publicly owned utilities formed. They aren't done every day. It's not an easy process. And I wouldn't necessarily advocate it in every situation. But you do have situations where the performance of the utility the public is so dissatisfied that they have the only protection that they have finally is to take is to provide that service as a public service. It's happened here in Oregon. It's happened across the country. Said it doesn't happen very often, but it's there. And I guess, again, I'm just trying to keep this, I think, what I hope are the basic issues here. You know, you've heard a lot of talk about buyers and reorganizations and scenarios and redistributions and what's going to happen. And we've been going through this now for, I don't know how many years, a couple of years now. We still don't have the answers. We don't know what Enron has in mind. We don't know what's going to happen. And it seems to me that now is exactly the wrong time to remove that fundamental protection that the ratepayers have. We don't know what's going to happen. Why take that last-ditch protection that consumers have to rely on away from them at this point? That seems to me, I think, to be the fundamental issue. This bill doesn't address governance or any of the other issues. This goes to this essential right of the public to form their own utility. And I hope you'll take that into consideration as you look at this amendment. We're very concerned about the precedent. We don't think that this is where you want to go. Thank you.
Mr. O'Connor, can you explain the fundamental right of representation on these decisions? How is it that 50 other cities would have no say in what one city decides to do on this? If they make a decision to condemn, where is it that the citizens of Salem, citizens of the other counties, Washington County, Clackamas County, where are their decisions, or where are their concerns being addressed if the city of Portland makes a decision and they have no redress with those politicians to make those kind of decisions?
Mr. Chair, you know, again, I don't think this goes to the governance issue. I agree there are legitimate questions around how you would structure a public entity to encompass the various communities and over that territory. You know, I've got some personal feelings about how, you know, you might go about that. But this bill doesn't go to that. This bill says you can't even get there. And I guess that's the part that's troubling to me. I mean,
What I'm hearing you suggest is that then, as a citizen of Salem, all I have to do is go up to the city of Portland and say, City Council, I would like you to go condemn, if I'm dissatisfied with what Enron's doing, I would like you to go condemn the PGE assets. And, you know, I should expect to get a response to my concerns by going up to the City Council of Portland. I mean, if this is provided, I mean, if this option still is out on the table for one city to do this, how is it that all the other citizens of Oregon that are being serviced by this utility, how are their concerns being represented?
Mr. Chair, I think there are legitimate governance issues that would need to be looked at if you're going to consider forming a publicly owned utility in this case. I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying that if you take away this right, there is ultimately no protection, I would argue, for those citizens in Salem or anywhere else from the potential abuses that are, or to date abuses that are out there, not from the Federal Regulatory Commission, not from the PUC. It is not a process that you would enter into lightly. I don't think that Portland would be able to do it, frankly, without some kind of broad consensus that that that's needed. I mean, what we need to do at this point, it seems to me, is not be looking at taking away these options, but looking at what, you know, what is going to come out of this proposed reorganization. What does it mean for the consumers and ratepayers of the PGE service territory? Let's get a good analysis of that, and then, you know, make some decisions for where to go.
Further questions? This Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, I took notes on some of your comments, in fact, all of them, and you made the comment that as an argument opposing the amendment, we don't know what is going to happen regarding Enron. I was thinking at the same time, if PGE were condemned by the city of Portland, we don't know what would happen in that circumstance either. And I'm wondering if that circumstance might be more frightening than the point you made about Enron. I mean, I think there are many, many questions. If the city of Portland took over Enron, there are many, many questions that all of us would ask, and right now we don't have answers for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Backlund, I mean, I agree. There are questions. It's an incredibly complex issue. We don't have the answers to a lot of questions. I agree. I personally think the danger of abuse from Enron is far greater than from somebody locally here that's operating under open meetings law, public records act, etc., where we know a little bit more about what's going on. But be that as it may, again, it seems to me that if we don't have answers at this point, we ought not to close off options. And ideally, you know, it would be great if there was a regional entity, perhaps, that had this authority in Nevada right now, in the area around the city of Las Vegas, the water authority down there. They're in a similar situation with Nevada Power. You know, in that case, there's a broad regional entity that's involved. It's a little easier that way, but it's not perfect. But I don't think we should be closing off options.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Tom, for that answer. I don't know that you've answered to my satisfaction, but that's okay. You also made the comment that you felt that this was a precedent. And I like to think I'm quite sensitive to precedent-setting decisions or actions. As I read the dash 3, I really don't see it as a precedent. So, again, I don't want to be argumentative. I just want you to know that I don't know that I would agree with you when you say that it sets a precedent. I don't think it does.
Representative Berger?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, the dash 3 amendments simply say that a city of a certain size, which we only have one in Oregon, cannot go and condemn property that belongs to an electric company. How would that keep the city of Coos Bay from being dissatisfied with Pacific Power and joining a PUD?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I guess, and I'm not trying to be facetious, this is a situation with preemptions that local governments, I guess, have always run into. You know, one person's narrow, you know, carved out narrow exception is another person's slippery slope to broad preemptions. And I guess our concern would be that if you do it in this case, what is to prevent should Coos Bay be in a situation where they feel the service that they're getting is so bad that they do need to join a PUD or form a municipal utility? If the legislature's done it in this case, then it sure seems to me it's awfully easy to change the number and go back and preempt Coos Bay. You know, the legislature's got
16,000 population? I don't think so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. I remember four or five sessions ago, we had a attempted legislative preemption of the authority of a city to cite a bike path. So, it's a concern that local governments always have. And
I'll just make a comment. I think it's a big stretch, though. I really do. I just can't imagine it interfering with anyone forming their own PUD or going through that process. And cities all the time become, they don't all accomplish it, as you said. It's not an easy thing to set up your own municipality. But I just can't see how the -3 amendments really have a nexus to my city or any other city in being able to do that.
Thank you. Further questions, Mr. O'Connor? All right. Thank you. Mr. Bissonnette.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bissonnette. I'm representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. Citizens Utility Board is statutorily charged with representing residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. That includes the customers of PGE. Although the chair made a joke of Mr. O'Connor not representing CUB, and he's right, he could in his statements. Residential customers of PGE need options. They do not need less of options. Mr. O'Connor said very accurately that Enron has not removed any options from the table. Mr. DiLorenzo said himself that he can't answer the question of whether or not Enron is going to sell PGE or not. He also noted that Mr. Cooper has left available a number of options. Mr. DiLorenzo himself outlined a number of theories throughout his testimony. Enron has options, every option open to it. The customers, the consumers of Oregon, of PGE, need every option open to it. We seem to see a high level of intent of trying to prevent a Portland problem. We don't have a Portland problem. We have an Enron problem. And we need the customers of PGE out from under that Enron problem. And we cannot afford to close doors in order to do that. We have Enron running a secret auction process that is very hard to get information out of. The only way we have been able to have any sort of public venue to discuss what may happen in the future of PGE is to have public efforts like Willamette Valley Power, which was active about a year ago, and the attempted public acquisition by the City of Portland of PGE, actually providing those venues for discussion of what possible futures for PGE and its customers, what will actually happen. Even the City of Portland has been hamstrung in being as forthright as I think they would like to be because of the confidentiality agreement that Enron requires in order for any participant to participate in the secret auction process. The fact that there's a saber rattling of a potential threat of condemnation, deflating interest in bids. We've had this secret auction process happening, it seems, almost forever now, but it's probably been only 6, 7, 8 months. And the auction process continues to be extended without the threat of condemnation because the management of Enron and the creditors of Enron continue to hope for bids. This is happening without the threat of condemnation, and still the customers of PGE, the consumers of PGE, have no further clarity of what's going to happen to their utility. The state of Oregon has no further clarity of what's going to happen to the state's largest electric utility today than we had at the beginning of the session, than we had at the end of last year, than we had when Enron actually declared bankruptcy. There's a concern that this isn't a precedent-setting process. How, you know, would the city of Coos Bay, for instance, be prevented from doing what they need to do in their area? Let's play some more what if. What if the city of Salem decides that it's in the interest, as representing a good number of PGE customers, to condemn the city of, or condemn PGE. Salem is the third largest city in the state. Do we then come in and change the law that we've just set? What if Gresham decides to, as the fourth largest city in the state? What if the cities of Beaverton, Hillsborough, and Tigard get together and form a Chapter 190 organization in order to decide to condemn PGE? Do we then see a change in policy for Chapter 190 organizations not to be able to exercise their rights of condemnation? We can play what if all day. Mr. O'Connor said it very, very well. We don't know what's going to happen, and consumers need options. Mr. DiLorenzo asked this committee to protect customers of PGE. Well, he doesn't speak for those customers. I do, and the Citizens Utility Board does. And what we are asking you to do is not this is not a protection, and this is not a bill that's in the interest of consumers. Consumers need all options. Again, we do not have a Portland problem. We do not have a Salem problem. We do not have a Gresham problem. We have an Enron problem. Keep the customers' options open and make sure that if Enron starts to take options off the table, we can take options off the table. Enron has taken nothing off the table. Neither should we. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions? Representative Flores.
Mr. Bissonnette, you've indicated, and you reiterate Mr. O'Connor's statement, that we don't know what's going to happen and that consumers need protection. So you're asking us to provide consumers protection against we don't know what. And how is that protection?
I guess I would sort of cite the Hippocratic Oath of first do no harm. Sometimes not doing anything is the best thing to have happen. We have, right now, the condemnation policy, the eminent domain policy, is in existence right now. Right now, I'm not sure there's a good reason to change that policy. I'm not sure that this is the time for legislative action of any kind. So what I'm first asking is to protect consumers, is to first do no harm. And at this point, I think that not acting on this amendment would be a good step in that direction.
In regard to doing no harm, then, what about all of the ratepayers who are outside Portland City proper? And I'm taking it that you disagree with the concept that that the rates set by PGE cannot include their debt service from Enron. And we're talking about PGE, not Enron. So how do we balance that?
The Citizens Utility Board represents all residential ratepayers of utility, and that includes outside of the city of Portland. This is not an issue of the city of Portland for us. If the city of Portland were to purchase, PGE, are there issues of how you get representation by the residents of the 49 other cities that are represented in the PGE service territory? Absolutely, there are, but we're not seeing an amendment to prohibit. We're not seeing an amendment yet to prohibit the public acquisition of PGE by the city of Portland or any other public entity. The same issues that exist in that situation exists in a condemnation, and again, that goes back to the issue of we need every option open to us. Do we need to figure out representation issues? Absolutely, we do, because we have members in Salem, in Beaverton, in Hillsborough, in Clackamas, in Oregon City, etc., and it is incumbent upon us to make sure that those ratepayers are represented just as well as a resident of the city of Portland. But at this point in time, this amendment, frankly, does nothing except remove options. You know, it could be that the representatives of the cities of Salem, Binghamton, Gresham, however many other cities in the PG service territory decide that condemnation is a good way to go. And they can decide amongst themselves, you know, do they get together and form a Chapter 190 and do it jointly? Do they decide that a city like Portland or Salem or whomever takes the lead? They could. But right now, this would remove an option from that table and from that list of potential actions, and that's not in the service of ratepayers.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate what the kind of work that you do. I think ratepayers need protection, and I'm glad to know that there are people like you that are watching out for ratepayers. But I'm just kind of curious about something. Did you have very similar concerns as you do about this, about deregulation?
Absolutely we did. And as a matter of fact, Enron purchased PGE in order to demonstrate how a utility would be deregulated. And as a matter of fact, within months after purchasing PGE, Enron filed a docket in front of the Public Utility Commission, UE 102, which basically said, today we have what we have, tomorrow it's everybody for themselves. We call it a very California-like deregulation plan. The Citizens Utility Board, working with a variety of other public interest organizations through the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, opposed that plan very much and said that is not in the interest of ratepayers. In fact, put our own plan forth in that docket and said that would be, you know, that first, residential customers are not deregulated. First, that generation assets are not required to be sold. Second, or thirdly, you have increased investments in energy conservation and renewable energy development. Fourthly, you have increased low-income bill payment assistance capability, and on and on and on. Enron's plan that they put forth in their docket was rejected by the PUC. And the PUC also said, if we wanted to go down this path, concepts that are put forth by the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition is a way we want to go. We subsequently came forth in the 1999 legislature and worked with the utilities, industrial customers, energy marketers, public interest groups to fashion a compromise in Senate Bill 1149 that actually did not deregulate residential customers, that did not require utilities to divest themselves of generation assets, that required increased investment in energy efficiency and renewable energy development, that did require increases in low-income bill payment assistance. So we absolutely had the same concerns about deregulation. As a matter of fact, shortly after the passage of Senate Bill 1149, which was very different than the view that Enron had of deregulation, they put PGE up on the auction block for the first time, and it's been for sale ever since.
Thank you.
Further questions, this panel? Representative Barnhart?
Thank you. You know, it sounds like, if I can paraphrase a little bit what you two have been saying, that this is a very blunt instrument to deal with all the potential problems that a condemnation might have. Just getting rid of it, of course, takes care of all of those potential problems, but it doesn't give you any of the advantages having that tool in your toolbox might provide. Would that be a fair way of summarizing your testimony?
That would be, I think, a fair summary from my end. Mr. O'Connor can speak for himself.
A follow-up on that, if I may. Is it possible that a bill might be crafted at some point that would put boundaries around the governance structure of a large multi-county municipally owned or operated utility that might be acceptable to you?
We'd certainly be
In the statute, somewhat in the statute.
We'd certainly be willing to engage in that discussion, yes.
Thank you.
Any further? All right. Thank you for your comments. And for the record, the chair did make the offer for the city of Portland to come forward to answer questions, and they have declined. And make the offer one more time. Okay. Any questions for the city of Portland? All right. All right. Let's see. Then, Representative Flores. Actually, let's just had a note come up from David Berenberg. You want to come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Berenberg from League of Oregon Cities, and I'll be very brief, if you let me. I just wanted to essentially say ditto to the comments from the League, to the comments that Mr. O'Connor and Mr. Bissonnette had presented, that if the issue was taking condemnation authority away from essentially any city in Oregon, we would come up and speak in opposition because we think it is an authority that has been an important one used for cities for many purposes, sparingly over time, but for important purposes, and something that we think has been handled in a very proper way by cities. We would essentially agree with the testimony of Representative Barnhart, essentially almost, on in terms of there are lots of issues that are raised in the condemnation of this particular issue, but there are mechanisms for discussion and for addressing the problems, and it comes down to a discussion of closing off an option in a very complicated circumstance where on one hand there has been clearly a history of problems on the Enron side and the corporate side there, and hopefully some resolution that will benefit the ratepayers and the citizens of Oregon, but one can't be sure. So at this time of uncertainty, it seems to me that I would rather have decisions and the opportunity to move forward in discussions on the behalf of some of the elected officials within the service district of PGE. How issues of governance and other things can be advanced, I think there's opportunities and abilities to have those discussions, but I think it's also early, and it's been late in this process, it's been going on a long time, but there's still a lot of discussion going on, and I think it would be beneficial to maintain the options on the table. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2356.
Your representative moves adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2356. Discussion? Any objection?
No. That's okay.
See no objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2356 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2356 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Monica Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel this is bad public policy, and I do think it sets a precedent. It means that we are meddling in local government business. Dealing with the condemnation authority, the eminent domain policy, I think is something that we should not be considering. This is a unique circumstance, but I think that we're overstepping our bounds. I don't think Portland is going to hold ratepayers defenseless. And if they do, I know that the legislators would do something about that. I do believe that condemnation is a last resort tool that local jurisdictions use. And I also take a look at all of the special districts, utility districts that we have in the state. They're doing very well. Their main interest is ratepayers, or they're doing well. Compared to Enron, let's put it that way, because they put their ratepayers first and not their stock holders or their CEOs. So that's why I'm going to be opposing this bill.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to speak, I hope briefly, on this. Representative Moniz Anderson has covered a couple of the points I wanted to make, and I won't repeat those. It's already been indicated by the representative of PGE, I keep getting those two mixed up, the representative of PGE, that having the threat of condemnation available may have an effect on the sale price or the sale value to a private investor of PGE. Of course, our interest in this is not to protect the sale price or potential value of PGE to Enron or Enron's creditors. Our interest, if we've got one here, is to protect the ratepayers of the state of Oregon from the possibility of PGE being operated in a way which is contrary to the interests of ratepayers. I think as we think about setting the policy that we're talking about in this bill, that ought to be our concern. I haven't heard anything today which tells me that removing the option of a local government to act in the way that it considers to be most beneficial for ratepayers will be, in fact, supportive of ratepayers. So removing that option, it will somehow help ratepayers. I don't get it. I don't see it. I don't understand how that could be. The reality, if anything, is the opposite. Removing the possibility of a condemnation, and therefore the protection that a possible condemnation provides in the discussion of price of PGE and the possible ways in which that asset might be disposed of by Enron through the bankruptcy process, having that available, that potential available, is actually what is going to be one of the better protections that ratepayers will have. Remember, private companies are designed to make money for investors. That's their function, and it's an important function, and I don't oppose that at all. But when we're talking about taking care of Oregonians, we're talking about protecting the ratepayer. For a private company, the product that it produces is important, but secondary to the business of making money for shareholders. Our interest is not in making money for PGE shareholder Enron. Our interest is in protecting ratepayers. There's nothing in this bill that I can see that promotes that. The other issue that's already been raised, I think is a very important issue, is that we start setting precedents for cities, for the restriction of cities' condemnation authority, I think we're asking for trouble. This organization, the legislature, is most of the time at best a blunt instrument. It doesn't have the capacity to make minor and quick changes in most situations. City governments, on the other hand, are in operation all the time. They are intimately familiar with the local conditions in their areas and are able to move relatively quickly on things that need to be done. For us to second-guess Portland in advance seems foolhardy to me, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. We should maintain these options. This bill should not go to the floor. Certainly, if it gets to the floor, it ought to be defeated. And I'll vote no here and there.
Further discussion? Representative Berger.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a completely different take on this. I fought very hard and voted against deregulation all the way through my first session at the legislature, with everyone telling me that the ratepayers were going to be protected by it and it wasn't going to go up. And that didn't happen. I'm really worried that the subject of condemnation ever came up. It seems to me that somewhere along the line, there were threats. Cities have the right of condemnation, and it's a very good right, and it's something that cities don't treat lightly at all. This threat of condemning PGE's assets, I found irresponsible. I also feel that Portland is a wonderful city and something to be very, very proud of in Oregon. And I have encouraged people in my rural area to really applaud Portland, be interested in the things that happen in Portland. And right now I have a list of things that I'm very supportive of: the harbor cleanup, the dredging of the river. And I want Portland to thrive, but I also want Portland to be responsible in the way that they move ahead with the kind of growth that they want. And I find this somewhat irresponsible. I also find that representing a rural part of the state, this offers me grave concerns about the ownership of PGE. And for that reason, I will strongly support the Dash 3 amendments.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I would disagree with the assumption that condemnation would be used in the last resort, because condemnation has been a discussion for a very long time and almost a leverage threat in this whole process. I reside in one of the counties that would be affected in Clackamas County, and I have talked with my county, and they are not supportive of the condemnation effort. I find it difficult to choose a government entity over a private enterprise, and I am concerned about some of the perhaps trending of some of the services that Portland would offer, and I like Portland, would offer in this particular instance as well. And we have examples in regard to water billing issues and so on. So I am going to be supporting this Dash 3 amendments and the bill on the floor, and thank you very much.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going back to my earlier comment that was said, we don't know what is going to happen regarding Enron, and I'm going to say we don't know what is going to happen should the city of Portland condemn PGE. Ratepayers have been talked a lot about today, the protection of ratepayers, and that question, should Portland, the city of Portland, condemn this, the issue of what would happen to ratepayers has not been dealt with. Ratepayers outside of the city of Portland. I'm concerned, for example, on the issue of access to preference power. That issue for me has never been addressed, except to say that right now it's fully subscribed, and what would be the effect should the city of Portland take over? Again, we don't know, and I can't imagine it could be a good one if it's already subscribed fully, and therefore if BPA had to go to the wholesale markets, that would drive up the price that ratepayers pay. So if we're protecting ratepayers, I don't think we're doing it if the city of Portland should condemn PGE. There are a number of other questions I could raise. My thesis, though, is that I think the potential for concerns being raised should there be a condemnation is greater than not. So, at any rate, I am going to support this bill.
Thank you. All right, call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Both aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
And chair votes aye, and I'll carry the bill to the floor as it passes to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And that concludes the work session on House Bill 2356. And nothing further before the committee. We are adjourned.